Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Middle Ground on the Coffee Party USA Internet Radio Network, hosted by Blog Talk Radio. The Middle Ground looks at today's political issues from left, right, and center. We're always civil and always looking for that middle ground where real conversation begins. You're here tonight with hosts Eric Feiler and Michael Charney. We thank you for joining us and hope you enjoy the next hour of the Middle Ground.
Can you unmute me? I don't know if anybody knows the show. Bye, Mom. Hey, this is Eric Beiler. I don't know if anybody can hear me. We're having trouble getting internet hooked up. So there may or may not be a show tonight, and there may or may not be internet. Thank you. If anybody can hear me, please unmute me. And I guess if I'm muted, you can't hear me. But somebody unmute me, please. Somebody unmute me. Somebody unmute me. Anyways, I'll just keep talking in case I am unmuted, but I don't know if I'm unmuted. Hey, Mom, can you turn on your internet thing? Yeah, your router thing.
Oh, hi, Eric.
Hey.
You can hear me. I can hear you. We have had a little internet trouble. Apologize for the problems to our listening audience. We logged in, and then I believe I'm as host, and I'm in a little bit of a weather situation, and it bounced me out. I just got back in. So,
okay.
Apologies for that. Welcome to the Middle Ground, Eric. Back over to you.
All right. I don't know if anything I said was heard, but...
It was all heard. I heard it all.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah, I heard it during the music. I heard it when you asked your mom to check the internet, everything.
Okay. Cool. Yeah, we actually bought this router thing. That's supposed to, like, give us internet wherever we are, but we can't get it to work. So I couldn't unmute myself, and I wasn't sure if I was. But anyways, at least there wasn't dead air. I just took my mom and dad out to dinner along with Annabelle. It's my dad's birthday as well as the 10th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. And tonight our guest will be David Swanson, who is an author and... one of the leading anti-war activists in the United States. Before we have him on, I just wanted to give you guys a bit of a request for your calls tonight. There's two things that Michael and I are interested in hearing. One is, if we were to suddenly have the $2 to $5 trillion that were spent on the war in Iraq to nation build at home, what are some of the things that we might have done instead? But also on a more personal note, how do you interpret your place in our democracy vis-a-vis the Iraq War? I don't know if any of us can just say it was them, it was the Republicans, it was Bush, it was Cheney, and leave it at that. Because if you were alive during this time, and you had the opportunity to be aware of what was happening, then in some way you are at least a part of that story. And decades from now, when people ask what happened, you will be one of the people who was alive and able to, you know, is able to be a witness to that history. Just like Annabelle and I have been talking to people who witnessed civil rights history 50 years ago in the last few weeks. So what is your, how did it change you? And how does it change the way that you see the you see your relationship to the federal government? So 646-929-2495 is the call-in number. David Swanson will be with us in about 10 minutes. And Michael, are you able to play the Lawrence Wilkerson clip from our show a few months ago?
Well, I am certainly able to hit the button. Shall we see what happens? For those of you who may not remember, a couple of months back we had Larry Wilkerson on the show. Larry Wilkerson was chief of staff to then Secretary of State Colin Powell, and was in the inner circle during the decision-making process, in fact, that led to the decision to invade Iraq 10 years ago today. And he had, he's had a number of interesting things to say since he's left the government employ, and not all of them terribly well received by people who still believe that the war was the right thing to do. To sort of refresh our memory on some of the things we had to say, we have this brief clip of his from that show, which should be along any mouse click now. So I don't think it's you, Eric, by the way,
that if even if Colin Powell had stood up and said, because of his objections on timing and legitimacy, which he could have well done, I'm leaving this administration because I don't agree with you, Mr. President, I don't think that would have stopped anything. I think George W. Bush and Dick Cheney would have marched right on to war, and they would have taken the nation with them. So I disagree with this idea that if Colin Powell had stood up and said, I'm resigning over this issue, that it would have stopped anything. The juggernaut was moving. The vice president was pushing the juggernaut as much as the president, if not more. And we were going to war. And Colin Powell's resignation would have been forgotten in a week.
Well, yeah, and I didn't bring up his resignation, but really it's just this from a citizen's perspective, and that's all I really am. And it was just the sense of shock that I felt, you know, being raised as a Republican, a military officer's son, that I could not trust, you know, because when 9/11 happened, I called my dad and I said, Dad, what should we do? And that's what so many of us as Americans wanted to do. It was our instinct to look to our leaders and say, what do we do? And then the answer was to go and invade the wrong country and to cause all these unnecessary deaths and to waste all of this money and to eventually put our country in the situation that we found ourselves at the end of that administration, all made in this fateful time. And I don't know why it is Colin Powell and you, Colonel Wilkerson, are the ones that we've looked to, not because we wanted you to resign so much, it's just that in some ways it was a loss of innocence for a lot of us as citizens. And I think in many cases, those of us who decided to become more vocal and more active, it spurred from that moment, also from Hurricane Katrina, which ironically we've had a little reminder of both in the last few months as we make this really important decision on November 6th.
Let me just say that, you know, I plead double indemnity, double guilt here, because I'd already been through this. You talk about not believing that your president could lie to you or not believing that the administration could lie to you. I went to war and fought for an administration that lied to the American people. I go every year without fail to that black wall down there in Washington and look at those 50,000-plus names on that wall, some of whom were my dear friends. Mm-hmm. And I think about my participation in that conflict under the false pretenses of Lyndon Baines Johnson and Richard Nixon, because both of those men lied to the American people, too. They lied from the Tonkin Gulf incident, which, of course, never happened, all the way up to the Paris peace talks. They lied to the American people. They waged a war that killed 50,000, 2.5 million Vietnamese, wounded horribly over 100,000 Americans. I mean, I've been through that before. So why I didn't recognize what was happening to us in 2003, I kick myself in the butt every day for.
So I wanted to share just a little bit of my conversation with my dad, also a lieutenant colonel in the United States Army, retired now, works for the Justice Department in the at Quantico. He teaches law to new recruits. Because I asked him about the Gulf of Tonkin. There's two reasons why I don't know much about it. One is I wasn't alive, but also I was a filmmaker. I didn't really understand the importance of knowing your history. I was 29 years old when September 11th happened, and I was, I guess, 30 when we invaded Iraq.
And I have to admit that if you'd asked me the Gulf of Tonkin versus Bay of Pigs, I might have got them mixed up at that time. I was a independent filmmaker, and none of that mattered to me, really. And there's something that our guest, who you're going to meet in a moment, David Swanson, said in his speech last night, that our inability to get the facts straight about past wars is what makes the future wars more likely to happen. And so with all the saber rattling about Iran, I just put this remembrance of the Iraq War in a completely different context, not necessarily about history or even politics, but just as our responsibility as citizens to know our history so that we can do a better job in exercising our civic duty.
Yeah, I have to, you know, I was alive during the Vietnam War, and I too would, I don't know that I would have gotten the Bay of Pigs confused with Gulf of Tonkin. The Bay of Pigs was the kind of thing that had us ducking and covering under our school desks as a regular exercise on the mistaken belief that they were somehow making us feel safe, because, of course, a nuclear blast couldn't get through a child's school desk. But I was not terribly aware of much of what happened during Vietnam. I was, in my tweens and teens, and it wasn't all that important to me. What I remember most was these were the days of the draft, and every year the newspapers would print the draft order. And for those of you who are too young to remember this, what would happen is basically they would pick all 365 days of the year out of a hat, essentially. It was, or balls machine, what it was. And based on the order that they came out, that was the order in which people would be drafted. And the general feeling was that during the Vietnam War, if you were in the first 200 or so dates that were pulled, you were likely to end up being drafted and likely to end up in Vietnam. And so even as kids, I remember looking at it was always on the front page of the paper, the LA Times. You'd look at the front page of the paper, and you'd look for your birth date, and you'd go, wow, if I was old enough this year, I'd probably be drafted, or, phew, wow, it's a good thing I'm not old enough, but if I were, I'd be safe this year. But beyond that, not much, a little bit of news, and I was completely unaware that we were being lied to. I do remember, the escalations and the debates and the protests and Kent State and all those things. But they were events like movies were events. They had a visceral effect on me, but they were still sort of out there. And it definitely was very different. And I think Vietnam was. Or maybe Korea, for people who remember Korea. I'd love to hear from anyone who would like to call in who remembers what this was like during Korea, if we have any listeners who are old enough to go back that far. But these just never felt like righteous wars the way, obviously, World War II did, for example. And I think it's absolutely true that there's been a continued deterioration, Eric, about... as Larry Wilkinson said, about the willingness to trust what we're told by our leaders, and we're supposed to be able to trust them on these things.
Well, David is going to be calling in from a 434 number. I know that because that's Charlottesville, Virginia. So as soon as you see him, let's bring him on. There's a couple other things that I learned last night from the speech that he gave that I wanted to toss out to you, Michael. One of them was that there's been studies on the cost of the war, and he cited a book, Joseph Stiglitz is one of the authors, and I know you had been interested in the fiscal impacts of the war. So I know that David has studied this tremendously, but Michael, before he comes on, maybe you could give us what your estimate is, based on what you've read, of what the fiscal impact of the Iraq War has been.
Well, I remember full disclosure, I didn't check this today. My memory is telling me that I remember numbers like $2.5 trillion, and that's Iraq, right? So that's not Afghanistan. And in my mind, not everyone agrees with me on this, but to me, they're very separate things. I have a lot more comfort. Comfort's the wrong word. It's easier for me to justify having gone into Afghanistan after 9/11. Very different set of circumstances in my mind. Whether we should or shouldn't ever, or whether war was the right answer, but a response to the Taliban who sponsored that kind of terrorism, I think was warranted in some respect. The Iraq was a completely different animal. So if I look at the $2.5 trillion, if that's the right number, and I found myself thinking this morning, right now our government is very, very dysfunctional, and they're basically arguing over $2 to $2.5 trillion, how to cut $2 to $2.5 trillion over 10 years. And if we spent $2 to $2.5 trillion over 10 years in Iraq, I think to myself, now I know this is simplistic, but the math is just, you know, it just kind of jumps out at me going, well, maybe we would have spent it anyway on other weird things that we shouldn't have spent it on. We'd be in the same position we are now. But I have to believe that some of that money would have been used differently, or would have been used to prevent our debt from going as high as it has. And I think it's just a tremendously lost opportunity. And in many ways, you know, I was looking at the number today, the number of U.S. casualties in Iraq. I think the number is around 4,400 dead, 30,000 or so injured. And by the way, that's not discounting the numbers anywhere between 1 and 400,000 I've read of Iraqis who died in that war, many of them civilians. I think to myself, okay, it's terrible, those casualties that we had in Iraq over the last 10 years, but in many ways, we as Americans have all been casualties of that war, and there are people, you know, who are poorer than they need to be today. There are people who maybe don't have the kind of safety net they would want to have today. Even as a Republican, I think the minimum safety net has eroded quite dramatically. There's a big gap between a decent safety net and a nanny state, and I think we're below that sort of lowered bar of a decent safety net. And so I think that there are, you know, potentially millions of casualties in the U.S., a different kind of casualty that are at least indirectly a result of this war. And I'm very curious to hear other people's takes on that thought. I think we do have our caller up now, Eric. I don't want to eat into his time. I know he's got very brief. So why don't you go ahead and introduce him?
Okay. This is David Swanson. He is an author and one of the preeminent anti-war activists in the United States. And if you go to our website, coffeepartyusa.com, you can see a very fresh speech from David Swanson that was filmed by me last night. David, thank you so much for joining us. Have you got him unmuted, Michael? Hope we're not having another one of those. Okay.
Hello, hello.
Okay, we got you. Whew.
Hey, can you hear me?
All kinds of technical difficulties
today. Can you hear me?
Today.
Hello.
Yes, we can. Can you hear me?
Oh, I've been hearing you all fine for quite a while, yes.
Okay, great, great. David, thank you for joining us.
Oh, of course. Glad to be here.
Michael just was citing the casualties, the United States casualties, which, as you mentioned last night, is pretty much the only number we hear. I wonder if you could expand our horizon a little bit and talk about the casualties in Iraq that were not United States soldiers.
Yeah, you know, when I tuned in, or when I dialed in, I was hearing that, you know, Afghanistan wasn't as bad as Iraq, and I think that's true in a number of ways. One of them is in terms of the number of dead bodies, but to me it sounds like saying, you know, this rape was not as bad as that rape, or this slavery operation is not as bad as that slavery operation. I mean, war is an evil thing, and if Iraq is a particularly evil war, so be it. But I don't think we should be talking about justifying other ones on those grounds. In Iraq, by the most credible counts and surveys that have the most respect from those who know that business, about 1.4 million Iraqis were killed as a result of Operation Iraqi Liberation, which began in 2003, and that's measured as above and beyond the outrageous death count, the horrific situation that faced that country in 2003, which was at that point at an all-time low following the most severe sanctions of modern history and bombings for years. And a previous war, and a war with Iran before that, and so you're talking about about 5% of the population of Iraq killed as a result of this latest war. That compares to the most awful bloody war ever in the history of the universe, as Americans are told, the U.S. Civil War, in terms of being a greater absolute number and a greater percentage. About half that number of Americans died, and about 2.5% of U.S. population died in the U.S. Civil War. And you look at the worst thing ever to happen in the history of the world, World War II. Most of the nations did not suffer the way that Iraq did. The United States lost 0.3% of its population. Japan 3%. France 1%. And so this was actually one of the worst things ever done to a nation in the history of the world. When you look at deaths and any other measure, when you look at over 4 million injured, over 4 million made into refugees, incredible counts of orphans and the traumatized and the destruction of infrastructure and education and nutrition and medical care. I mean, this is a society and a culture that have been devastated. And we talk about the U.S. deaths, which were about 0.3% of the Iraqi deaths, and we read about them in U.S. newspapers, and we're told this is the death count. And kids who grow up in the United States have no idea that anybody died beyond that 0.3%.
You're absolutely right. This is Michael David, by the way. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you.
I would love to discuss Afghanistan a bit more, but it's a little bit off topic, and frankly, you're far more the expert than I am. But with respect to Iraq, I have a couple questions, and Eric will be back on in a minute, but he's actually driving right now, so he's kind of in and out with a signal a bit. Do you have a sense of, or do you know the numbers of what percent or of the 1.4 million, and that is a number much higher than I've heard, I absolutely take your word for it. What was sort of the civilian count versus... Don't do that? You're right, I won't do it. I'll check it later. Or somebody in the chat room can go check on it, I'm sure. I was looking at, just before the show, I was trying to find a number. And if you go to just something simple, like if you search for Iraqi casualties and look at the Wikipedia accounts, the first thing you realize is there are at least 15 or 20 different reporting agencies, and the numbers range, they're just all over the map.
Well,
I've seen numbers as low as, 100,000. Not that that's a low number.
If you go to warisacrime.org, you'll find at the very top my report that I published yesterday, that begins by going through where those different numbers come from and which should be believed and why. So, read that and see what you think.
Okay, fair enough. Do you have a sense of what the breakdown was, civilian versus military? I have to think a large percentage of that was civilian.
The vast majority is civilian. It's not something that is easy to count, or that I can give you a number with the same confidence, even that I can give you the 1.4 million, which is not with perfect confidence itself. And it's not a distinction that I place a lot of value on or interest in, frankly. I mean, if our nation were being bombed, we would not consider it remotely more justifiable to kill people who were fighting back than to kill people who weren't fighting back. And when you're fighting a war in people's cities and towns and villages and farms, making the distinction between who's a civilian and who's a combatant is extremely difficult. It's also really kind of questionable as to what the point is. But these are deaths, the vast majority of which are violent, and the majority of which are directly caused by the United States and its allies, but others of which are considered indirectly caused. And so if you declare the war over when Bush was on the aircraft carrier in San Diego, and you label the rest of it a civil war, then obviously you get a different body count. But this is considering the effect of 29,200 airstrikes in the initial assault in 2003, and another 4,000 airstrikes over the next 8 years. I mean, this is devastating warfare from the air, and that's the big killer here.
So interesting. I'm curious about your take on some of the, you know, the bullet point justifications. And obviously today there was a tremendous amount of chatter, you know, across the Twitterverse and on blogs and everything about the anniversary, and all of those old justifications came up. So what do you say to people who say, like on one side, well, you know, we liberated Iraq. What was wrong with liberating Iraq? Or what do you say to people on the with an opposite view who would say, you know, we were only there for the oil? I mean, how do you sort of get a handle on helping people rationalize this? Because obviously people are trying to.
I mean, if China carpet bombed the United States and occupied it for a decade, and then they had a conversation in China where certain Chinese experts maintained that they had liberated the United States and others maintained that maybe they really hadn't because it had been so bad, what would be missing from that conversation? American voices, right? Well, we talk about whether we liberated Iraq, and we don't bother to think, hey, maybe we should go ask the Iraqis. And when you go ask the Iraqis, they say, the disaster that you had created in our country by 2003 and the horror that was the Saddam Hussein government was far, far better than where we are now. The first Gulf War was devastating to infrastructure in Baghdad and elsewhere in Iraq, but repairs were significantly made relatively very swiftly by the horrendous Saddam Hussein government. Now, the devastation of 2003 has yet to be repaired. They don't have electricity in Baghdad. You have to have a generator to get electricity in Baghdad 10 years later, right? This is with the glorious civilized corporate reconstruction by the Bush and Obama administrations. That, you know, we haven't fixed the damage. There are not hospitals. There are not schools. 80% of the teachers in Baghdad are gone. The educated class from the entire country is gone. This is the country that was the top in education 20 years ago and now leads the region in illiteracy. There was open homosexuality. There were women uncovered. There was liberalization. I'm not saying you couldn't get murdered or tortured by that government. Of course you could. But now you can't set foot outdoors without facing violence, without facing fundamentalist religious demands. You can't go from neighborhood to neighborhood without checkpoints. In 2002, nobody cared who was Shia Sunni. They didn't know. They had mixed marriages. Now it's a question of life or death. And so to say that we liberated the place, is just a mockery.
So the one of the counters on the other side is that it was always and completely about the oil. Is that something that you buy into also?
Well,
why do you think we went in?
I mean, it's dangerous ever to say anything is all and completely about one reason when it's something that's
complicated.
Of course,
but that's the American psyche, right? We need the simple binary answer.
Well, I can't help with that, but I think that that oil was very central, was very much important. I think that Antonia Juhas, who is really an expert on this issue, who managed to get an op-ed on CNN's website today, has it dead right. And of course, 10 years ago, you never saw a headline, "The War Was for Oil," on CNN's website, I guarantee you. But it was the oil companies that met with Dick Cheney and asked for the war. It was the oil companies that demanded the war, that demanded the surge, that demanded the so-called benchmarks that were never met, that were supposed to gauge the success of the surge that was then declared a success anyway. And it is the oil companies that are now in Iraq. Iraq was entirely nationalized. Its oil belonged to the nation of Iraq entirely in 2003. Now you have foreign corporate oil companies going in and taking that oil and taking various degrees of profit. And there's so much violence and insecurity and instability and corruption that a lot of them are more interested in Kurdistan in the north than in Baghdad. They're not going in to the extent that was envisioned. And in part, that's because of the resistance of the Iraqi labor movement and the Iraqi people that said, we don't want to give these corporations the kind of deal they want, where they take all the profits. Because that was part of the goal. And the oil law that was supposed to be passed in 2005 and in 2007 and on and never got passed and hasn't yet, sure, you know, was written in Washington, D.C. by oil companies.
Right. So yeah, I read that same article on CNN, and
you did, you know, good.
I didn't have a chance to go back and look at some of the sources that he cited, but it was a very compelling case. Today, literally on the anniversary, there was, and I'm sure you're aware of this, there was an attack, right? And it was a sectarian attack. I'm going to embarrass myself. I believe it was Sunnis attacking Shia, but I may have that backwards. With apologies to anyone, I should know that the answer to that. And I think 60 people were killed today. Supposedly, quote unquote, the war is over. It clearly isn't. I mean, maybe our active role in the war is over, but is this country in any way close to being stabilized? Does it have a stable government? Are we looking at, have we created essentially I shouldn't say create, we clearly have created. Are we never going to see the end of essentially this hornet's nest in the Middle East? And by the way, attached to that is this idea that now Iran apparently could turn it into a puppet state if we stay too far afield.
Well, anything is possible. I want to resist saying we when we talk about our evil government that doesn't represent us. But the U.S. government has indeed created a disaster in Iraq, has created an unaccountable, undemocratic government, has appointed leaders that are still in power, who are absolutely corrupt, who are in very grave danger of losing power and seeing the nation split. Now Vice President Joe Biden was preaching for years, let's cut it in thirds. Well, they may have accomplished that in slow motion. It may end up cut in thirds. That's not guaranteed, never was, but it could happen. The sectarian divisions that were intentionally promoted by the U.S. occupation for years have grown and grown. You cannot go in and hire people of one religious belief to kill people of another and not have this kind of result. You cannot go in and work with the torturers and the assassins on one side against another and not have these kinds of results. So the idea that the United States went in and then the foolish backward Muslims created their own civil war and so we couldn't help them because they weren't ready for democracy is just to add insult to injury. This is something that was done quite deliberately as a divide and conquer and an ill-thought-out plan that was based on very short-term thinking. And now you have a very divided country with rulers who are still tied to the United States, even though the U.S. influence is shrinking by the day. You have the U.S. military largely gone, but the CIA moving in greater numbers, which is never helpful. Under the guise of going after terrorists who are active in Syria and Iraq. Of course, there was not this terrorism in Iraq before 2003. There was no such thing as al-Qaeda in Iraq. These are creations of the occupation, and they are dangerous ones. I don't think Iran is about to take over Iraq. I don't think any other nation is about to. I think the nations of that region have an interest in peace and stability, but I think there are these sectarian and ethnic and regional tensions that have been made so severe and are being made worse by what's happening in Syria and what's being threatened in Iran that it really could be a major disaster. It's never yet been the huge escalation of violence that we were told on Fox News year after year would result if the U.S. ever withdrew. And as the U.S. and allies withdrew, you saw reductions in violence. But it could become that. It could become as bad or worse than it was 5 years ago.
So I want to shift gears a little bit. And by the way, I apologize. I'm not sure how much time you have with us. If you need to go or if you have other scheduling, please let me know. But I did want to broach something that Eric was particularly interested in. I'm sorry, he's still a little out of zone apparently, and that is this idea of, and I realize we're going to be guessing a little bit because it's sort of a future question. As we move into the future, there inevitably will be other situations, foreign policy situations, which create tremendous amounts of tension. I mean, Korea now, right, which has sort of taken over the headline. North Korea has taken over the headlines from Iran. What do you think that the situation in Iraq and the 10 years and the build-up to going into war, what effect do you believe it has had on our ability as a nation or our government's ability to lead in a way that where we might need to do something like that again for the right reasons? And I'm putting the word right in quotes. I'm not talking about preemptive strikes, but have we basically jeopardized, has the government jeopardized the ability to ever get the faith of the American people behind a war effort if we need one?
Well, I'm going to disagree with you in that I fervently wish that were the case. I do not think there is such a thing as a war for the right reason any more than there's a rape or a child abuse or an enslavement for the right reason. I think war is the most evil thing we've come up with, and we do not need it. We have alternatives. It doesn't serve a useful purpose, and we should stop fantasizing that there's going to be a good one or a justified one next month or next year or next decade, because that's what keeps us dumping over half of discretionary spending of our public treasury into preparations for war every year when we need that money for useful purposes, and it generates arms races and hostility and violence and occasions for war rather than helping to prevent them. I think that we did enlighten the American people to a considerable extent that a president can lie you into a war. We have tremendous resistance to understanding and agreeing with the idea that they always lie us into every war. There's this notion that it was just this one war that they lied about, whereas in my view, they were incompetent liars, this crowd, just as they were incompetent in many other things, and the lies are often more competently told. But I think what we accomplished most significantly is that we doubled the military-industrial complex. We gave it unprecedented power. We've given the CIA war-making powers. We've taken powers of war decisions out of the Congress and put them in the White House, which now openly defies the UN and the Congress and the people and the rule of law. And we have a resolution in the Senate right now with well over a majority of senators' names on it that would effectively give Israel the power to launch the United States into a war in Iran, which goes way beyond giving war powers to a president. It gives them to another country. And so I think the damage that's been done in terms of stripping away our rights under the guise of wartime emergencies, the indefinite detentions, the torture, the rendition, the assassinations, the president flipping through a list of men, women, and children every Tuesday and picking who to kill and killing them without too many people batting an eye. I think this is putting us in a very, very dangerous situation. The corruption of our elections that grows with every Supreme Court decision and every election cycle is in large part the corruption of the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned of. And as it grows, so does the likelihood of more wars. And we can argue about which ones are desirable. I consider them all undesirable, but I think we are more likely to have them the more we put the money and the momentum into it, as well as the more we start thinking that wars are for women's rights and wars are for gay rights and so forth. We have to break out of that idea.
Well, I concur with you on that last point. I think the use of the war as a metaphor is a dangerous cultural habit that we've gotten into. I want to back up a second, though, because, first of all, please don't misunderstand me. I can't imagine a desirable war. Okay, so to me, there's nothing between undesirable and desirable. It would be incredibly undesirable and stupid and harmful versus, sort of a... I don't know even the right words to use.
If the public would never again accept a war, that would be a good thing. You seemed worried that the American public would fervently resist any new wars. I only wish that were the case, but you seemed worried that that might be the case.
No. I'm not. Well, worried is the wrong word. I think that. Sadly, I'll share what I think. What I hear is a little bit of a cynical view. I think that with the right story and the right spin and the right marketing and political and and military machinery behind it, frankly, we can probably be sold. The majority of us can probably be sold anything. But I do think that there's a distinction in, for example, getting into war as a means of defense. So if, you know, I'll use some of the, you know, the sort of simplistic examples. If North Korea did in fact, were in fact stupid enough but had the ability and launched a nuclear missile at the U.S. And somehow it got through our defenses and, you know, took out San Francisco, what would you suggest if not some counterstrike? I mean, if they make it clear that their intention is to fire nuclear weapons at us, and they do so, in fact, you don't think we would be justified in going to war with North Korea? Maybe justify is a strong word. You don't think
we'd all be dead, so I wouldn't give a rat's rear end whether we'd been justified or not.
Okay, but work with me on the counterfactual for a moment.
there's a danger in looking at the wrong hypothetical situations. There's a danger in imagining that a nation, you know, smaller than New Jersey with a military budget smaller than New York City is a threat to the United States empire. There's a danger in imagining that with the United States building massive military bases all around China, including off of South Korea and all around the Pacific, and pushing hostility on North Korea, that the North Koreans are sort of irrational, not quite civilized folks who are getting hostile towards us for inexplicable reasons and might be so suicidal that they wanted to attack the U.S. and its nuclear arsenal. I mean, I think it's dangerous to think in those terms because it creates a justification not just for imagining that if somebody started to destroy the globe, we would jump in and help them, but for putting our money into the nuclear arsenal and into the whole military machine. I mean, there's a reason why the Koreans and the Chinese are escalating their military spending, all of which remains a teeny tiny fraction of U.S. military spending, and it is the U.S. buildup. We are the bully. We are the threat. We are the ones turning Jeju Island off of, you know, right off of China into a Navy base, and figuring out possible first strike scenarios. And so I think it just puts us in the wrong frame of mind to start wondering whether Iran or Korea might really decide to nuke us. We are the only nation that has ever used nukes. We are the only nation that threatens to use nukes. I think it's the wrong hypothetical.
Fair enough, and I admit to choosing a hypothetical that is, you know, sort of an extreme version. But I guess I'm having a little difficulty with the idea that if we are attacked. I mean, there's a couple. There are a variety of scenarios. I mean, I kind of bucket these things into three pieces. And it looks like we're having a real technical problem with Eric. My attempt to get him back online is stuck. And unfortunately, I have no way. Maybe somebody in the chat room could tell Eric to try to call back in again. It might be helpful. I'd appreciate that if somebody could do that. But I'm sorry. So kind of three simplistic buckets. One is something in which we are clearly the aggressor, the invader, for whatever reasons, whether they are, you know, anything as absurd as you know, American exceptionalism, or we should have a right to as much oil as we want, or whatever it is that we think we have a right to and we don't, and I put Iraq in that category, completely and totally unjustified. There's sort of a second category of, if an ally, if an important ally is attacked, you know, would we at some point, or should we at some point, go to the aid of our ally? And obviously the most common example is Israel. I actually don't think that's a good example because I've spent a lot of time there. I know a lot of people there. I have no worry about them being able to defend themselves. But then there's another, a third category, which is we are attacked. And we were attacked on 9/11. We were attacked in, at Pearl Harbor. So the fact that we're big and powerful doesn't mean that people won't want to and can't find a way to attack us. Are you saying that you don't even see in that third scenario a path whereby the appropriate, I'm not going to say the right thing to do, but the appropriate thing to do would be to engage in counteroffensives of some kind, whether you want to call it a war or not, but to engage in military activity?
Well, I appreciate the length of the radio show because I cannot and will not answer that in a soundbite, and I cannot answer it in a way that doesn't risk you're thinking I'm being evasive, but I have to answer it honestly, and I think it's a rather complex question.
I'm good at asking those, I've been told.
No, it's a great question. I don't know how to answer it in 10 seconds. Pearl Harbor was not in the United States. It was in the territory of Hawaii, which the United States
yes,
was
right.
in the
you're
process
right.
of trying to make into its empire, and it was the result of years of very careful and intentional provocation of the Japanese, and it was used to create engagement in a war that was the single worst thing this planet has ever seen. When the World Trade Center was first attacked years earlier, those found guilty were prosecuted and put in prison. When the World Trade Center was attacked again, the Taliban government in Afghanistan told the White House they were willing to turn bin Laden and anybody else over to a neutral third country to be put on trial and have them tried for the crime. When President Bush was intent on attacking Baghdad, Saddam Hussein told the president of Spain to tell the president of the United States he would like to abandon his government and leave the country if they wouldn't kill him. When a nation wants war, it wants war. And when a crime is committed by a group of individuals, but the nation wants war with a nation or with another nation that had nothing to do with it, then that's what it goes for. Whereas the rational, civilized response, never mind avoiding the provocation of the crime to begin with, would be to prosecute the criminals for the crimes. The reason I wrote a book a year or two ago about the peace movement of the 1920s and 30s in this country is that people thought this way. They thought that when nations agreed to attack other nations that attacked their allies, it created World War I, that when nations armed each other and prepared for war and didn't think about ways for peace but scenarios that might be justified means to war, it resulted in wars. And so they banned war. They made it illegal. It's been illegal since 1928, the Kellogg-Briand Pact, which has some 80 nations signed onto it, makes all wars, humanitarian, philanthropic, defensive, and the rest of them, illegal. And this was because the people who were doing it weren't thinking in terms of some other nation is going to attack us and we're going to have to defend ourselves, and maybe we'll have to defend ourselves preemptively, and maybe we'll have to preemptively arm ourselves better than they are, and so forth. They were thinking, war is so barbaric, and it takes two to tango, that if we set war behind us, it won't be part of global culture anymore, and we'll do it first by making it illegal, as we made blood feuds illegal, as we made dueling illegal. And we didn't make aggressive dueling illegal and permit defensive dueling. We set the whole barbaric practice behind us with slavery, with blood feuds, with cruel and inhumane and unusual punishments. So that we'll do it by making war illegal, which they did, and then we'll establish standards and international laws and courts of arbitration and settlement with the power to prosecute war makers, and nobody will agree to go to war because somebody else was attacked anymore, and we won't create an international war-making body like the UN or NATO to enforce the absence of war. We will enforce the absence of war by ceasing to engage in war. And I think that remains the right idea. And I think it remains, it's now become an idea that it's very, very hard for anybody to wrap their mind around, as it was hard for most people back then. But it's, you know, it's not an idea I can easily put in a soundbite. So what I usually do is point out the absolute absurdity of the idea that some nation would attack the United States, which has a global empire and a military force the like of which the world has never seen. It would be national suicide to imagine it. And that if individuals attack the United States, they should be prosecuted for their crimes. And they can't do it if we're promoting global lawlessness and assassinating anybody in any country with flying killer robots. They can do it if we support the rule of law over the rule of force.
Well, a very good answer, actually. I'm sure you've heard, I wouldn't be the first to tell you that there's a utopian flavor to what you're saying, but that doesn't mean it's not a good idea.
It's utopian, I agree. It's also absolute essential survival. I mean, we are all going to die if we don't do that. We are all going to die if we don't do a few other things, including creating a sustainable energy program. But how you're going to create a sustainable energy program when you're putting all your money into weapons and foreign bases is beyond me. But the proliferation of nuclear weapons, the proliferation of other weapons, the promotion of absolute lawlessness in war-making, and the antagonization of other nations that our nation is engaged in are at some point, if it continues indefinitely, going to result in the intentional or accidental or fit of rage breakout of a nuclear strike by us or somebody else that's going to be responded to. I mean, we are not going to survive down this path. So, you know, the idea of surviving, of going back to the level of weaponization of this planet and outer space that existed, you know, a couple centuries back, you know, may be utopian. But it's the only way we're going to survive.
Well, certainly there's, you know, there's an argument to be made that in the last century, you know, weapons technology has just outstripped our ability to manage conflict. And so, you know, if you look back through history, of course, the utopian argument is that you can go back to, you know, Grog and Zed, right, arguing over, you know, who's going to get the better hunting ground. But they had clubs, right? And now we have, as you say, we have nuclear weapons, we have chemical weapons, biological weapons, and I think fundamentally you're right that the path we're on. I'm not sure. The path we're on would lead one to believe that sooner or later a conflict will escalate to such a massive level that it would mean a very, very large swath of destruction. On the other hand, since World War II, I don't know what the numbers are, but I believe, you know, at any point in time, if you look now, there's certainly dozens or scores of wars going on around the world at any given time, and they tend to be very localized conflicts. And I don't see that. I mean, part of what you're saying, I think, implies some sort of governmental structure, right? And it may be fine if it would be more than fine if the United States and the United Kingdom and Israel and even Iran and even North Korea, certainly controlled governments in China, were to say we're just not going to go to war. But there's a big chunk of the world that's still tribal. Afghanistan as a nation doesn't have the status as a nation to control itself not to go to war, because it's fundamentally not organized that way. It's a myth in our minds that Afghanistan is a nation in the same respect that the U.S. is a nation or the U.K. is a nation or even, you know, Argentina is a nation. And so I wonder sort of how does your picture play when you sort of put that flavor on things, that a big chunk of the world just isn't organized to do what you want to do?
Well, I mean, I agree with 90% of what you just said, but
I'll take it. I'll take the 90%.
I'm sensing, you know, I'm sensing this idea that war has always been part of humanity, and it's something that civilization and progress have moved us away from. And I think the numbers actually suggest the exact opposite, that in fact, in large part because of exactly what you said about weapons, but you know, war is there's just no evidence whatsoever of war before about 12,000 years ago, and there would be in the bones. And people pretended there was, anthropologists imagined there was, for, you know, in the 1950s you could go in a museum and see the scars of war on ancient human bones, and of course they were the scars of the big cats and other animals for which ancient humans were dinner. The ancient humans were not engaged in war. It was with the coming of complex sedentary societies that you begin to have war, and you had it sporadically here and there. Some cultures yes, some cultures no. It comes and it goes, and it turns out after, I mean, there's a great book came out last year, I think, by a scientist, an author named John Horgan, that looks at all the possible factors that could cause war to increase or decrease, you know, in terms of education or type of government or concentration of population or resources or climate change and the rest of it. And it turns out that war just increases or decreases with cultural acceptance of war. It's a meme, or if you prefer, it's a plague. It's a disease. It's an infection, and war is continued by cultures that support the idea of war, and none has ever done so to the extent and with the reach and the power and the damage of ours at the moment. Afghanistan has not attacked anybody. You know, the idea, sure, there is incredible violence in Afghanistan and division within Afghanistan, and it's been promoted heavily by outside forces for centuries, including by the United States with help from the Soviet Union for the past 40 years. But the idea that you know, the civilized Western nations might be willing to move away from war, but the backward, poverty-stricken tribal states wouldn't. You know, even if Afghanistan wanted to put together the effort to attack another country, it absolutely doesn't have the means to do it. You know, the major force for war in the world is our government. We are over half of military spending with our NATO allies. We are three-quarters of military spending. NATO has now become a global aggressive force, not a defense of Europe. And foreign weapons sales to democracies and dictatorships around the globe, far and away, the leading exporter of weapons is the United States. We go to war against U.S.-made weapons. Other nations go to war with both sides using U.S.-made weapons. This is not the path that we should be contributing to. We should not be selling weapons of any sort to anyone. We should not be investing to the extent we are in our own weapon systems. And, you know, the idea that we need, you know, 10 times the military budget of our next alleged enemy, and that if we only had 9 times, we wouldn't be defending ourselves, when most of the weapons we spend money on have no defensive purpose whatsoever, and when we have built bases and troop occupations in 177 nations that the Pentagon admits to, plus some. You know, it just seems outrageously insulting to me to pass the buck to Afghanistan and say the third poorest nation on earth, which we've been occupying for over a decade, bringing enlightenment to, and kids are starving to death this past winter and freezing to death this past winter. You know, I mean, I think we're pointing the fingers in the wrong directions.
Well, I'm going to agree with 90% of what you just said.
Good.
And I, you would absolutely get no argument from me about the spending, about and of course related to that is what we could be doing with that money, whether it's reducing the debt or spending it on infrastructure or education or to raise the level of the social safety net. There's no question in my mind that the amount of money that we spend on the military is just outrageous. I mean, it's incomprehensible that that any sort of rational body politic could have come to the conclusions that we've come to, that we should be spending this kind of money and justifying it somehow by saying that we would, you know, if we cut 5,000 troops somewhere, we'd be a much weaker nation, or if we stopped building the F-35.
Exactly. I have another idea what we could spend it on. You know, when 9/11 happened, you know, I spoke with a woman from Iran who's won a Nobel Peace Prize, a woman named Shirin Ebadi, and she said, you know, what the United States ought to do is build schools in Afghanistan and name them for victims of 9/11, and build hospitals in Afghanistan, and build infrastructure and green energy and agriculture in Afghanistan, and teach people. Well, you know, 90% of the people in Afghanistan don't oppose or support 9/11. They've never heard of it.
Right? Exactly.
And so, when you're talking about $4 or $5 trillion that we've spent on destroying the nation of Iraq, and that's what we've done, we've destroyed it. And the United Nations says it would take $30 billion to end starvation, to end hunger, to end, you know, the starving to death of millions of children every year in the world. Well, by my calculation, you could end hunger for 167 years for what you spent destroying Iraq. So you could save the lives of millions of people year after year for what you spent to kill a million people. So in fact, the lost opportunity in terms of human good far outweighs the damage of what you actually did spend it on. And so I'm not against spending U.S. money within the U.S. as well. But the U.S. is actually a very wealthy place, and we would realize that if we divided the money in any sort of sane manner and didn't give most of it to a few hundred people.
Completely different topic. That's for another show, though.
Well, it is a very big topic, as is this one, but it's you know, military spending funnels money into the pockets of billionaires. I mean, this is why we spent $60 billion reconstructing Iraq, and we imagined that we reconstructed something. And, you know, we spent a third of it on security to protect the people who were pretending to reconstruct things, and most of the rest of it on corruption. Right. You know, most of the reconstruction money for Afghanistan never leaves the United States. And so it is a very unaccountable means of funneling our hard-earned money into some completely unscrupulous pockets under the waving of a bunch of flags and war music.
Yeah, I agree. I love the idea of, you know, if that money were used to actually do the kind of rebuilding and educating that we claim to want to be able to do, or that we claim the reasons for liberation. Of course, you and I both know that it would be hard for somebody to figure out how to make a profit on that, and so it's not where the money's going to go, where the easier profit is in a lot of these cases, in virtually all of these cases. And I think, you know, fundamentally that's at the heart of all of this. There are few endeavors more profitable than war.
For certain individuals,
but as an absolute, it is a highly lucrative business.
Well, not for a society, and
not for
particular profiteers. Absolutely.
Yes, exactly. I'm talking about in terms of generating raw dollars. No question about it. I want to, you know, I'd like to kind of give you the last word. First of all, I want to apologize to you, David. We expected to take calls, expected to have more conversation with Eric. I want to also apologize to all the listeners. We're going to wind the show down now with respect to David's time. Our technical problems have prevented any calls from coming. I mean, I see calls on the board, but I cannot get to them. Something in the technology that we're using tonight is just not in a good mood, I guess. So we've managed, once we get somebody like you and I online, we've been able to stay connected. But I could mute you if I wanted to, which maybe your cue to say whatever you want. and I can't, unfortunately, bring in any of the callers. So I know we have a caller from 518. We had, I think, Neil from Fort Lauderdale on the phone waiting to get in. I believe Eric just came in again. Eric, are you back with us?
I am. Can you hear me?
Oh, it's a miracle. I don't quite know how that happened, but we've got you back in. So I know there were a couple of topics you wanted to cover with David, and then we should probably wind the show down because we are having difficulty getting any other callers in. I'm just getting lots of spinning circles on the technology tonight.
Yeah, just so you know, I had to call in like 15 times. I got a busy signal when I
there's
to call back in.
There's something. I'll apologize to the listeners. You don't need to know. it's our internal problem to sort out. We probably need a better secondary system for how to handle these issues. But certainly, we're glad to have had you, David. And by the way, thank you, David, because if not for you, it would have been me talking to myself for an hour, and we would have lost the audience almost instantaneously, trust me.
Well, I totally agreed it. I enjoyed it, and there were plenty of great questions. And if people think I said something outrageous and want to track me down, I'm at davidswanson.org.
All right. Why don't we give Eric just a minute to maybe hit you with one or two more thoughts, and then we'll wind the show down.
Is that okay, David?
Sure.
Okay, well, here's the thing. I mean, you really got me thinking with your speech last night about how lies about past wars make future wars more possible, more likely even. And I've actually been encountering a lot of revisionist history in the time that I've spent in the South recently. There are people who are trying to rehabilitate the image of the Ku Klux Klan, for instance. Very different narrative about the Civil War coming from people in the South. We encounter, the Japanese Prime Minister recently denying war crimes that Japan committed during World War II. And so I noticed that there always tends to be a war about the war, a narrative war about the past war. And you mentioned the surge as if everybody knows that the surge was just basically a very expensive PR campaign, but I don't think everybody knows that. I think most Americans buy the narrative that the surge was the thing that salvaged the Iraq war so that we don't have to look upon the Iraq war as a disaster, and therefore any future war is more viable because the last war wasn't as much of a disaster as it would have been if we hadn't stayed the course and had that surge. So I just wanted to address that since it does, I think, have ramifications for the quote-unquote next war.
Well, I agree. I kept saying I agreed with 90%. I agreed with 100% of that question and its premises, and I think it is important because Obama really sold the escalation in Afghanistan on the idea that the escalation in Iraq had somehow transformed that war from a bad one that he had once said was a dumb one, into a good and noble one, as he now talks about it. And as I mentioned last night, the Pentagon is spending $65 million on rehabilitating the Vietnam War, doing events and promotions around the country to make the Vietnam War seem better. That's important to them because it's seen as a bad war. And when you have one of these endless occupations and people are demanding that it end, and we had a majority of Americans wanting it ended from, 2004 at least forward, you have not demanding that it end that day, but wanting it ended that year, year after year after year. You have this conversation going on in Washington that switches back and forth between we're losing so we need more troops and we're winning so we need more troops. And when people tire of that, then they really start focusing on we're about to win, we're about to win, we're about to win. And and this is the case with past wars, many wars, not just Iraq. And you saw even with Vietnam, hopeless, endless war, and they escalate it and they do this vicious carpet bombing of Hanoi and Haiphong, and they declare a victory, and then they leave on exactly the same terms that they could have negotiated before killing all those additional people. And this is the case with Iraq. You could have negotiated the Status of Forces Agreement exactly on the same terms before, during, or after the surge. And so you have this show of toughness, this we're going to escalate, we're trying something different, this isn't more of the same, and so we don't want this talk of withdrawal, this is different, we're having a surge now. And so this is what happened when we overwhelmingly elected Democrats to Congress, and overwhelmingly the top issue was the war, and overwhelmingly people wanted out. we got an escalation of the war, and we were all told in a very bipartisan manner, this is a different approach. This is not, you know, just more of the same. This is something new and different, and we're going to get tough. And so then you wind up with this status of forces agreement that you could have had before, that the Iraqi parliament only agreed to on condition that they would get a public referendum with the opportunity to say everybody get the hell out now, not in 3 years. And then they were denied the opportunity to ever have that referendum. But when you had this surge, they not only said it was a different approach, they said we have benchmarks, we're going to measure the success. And they said it year after year after year. They were going to have an oil law, a debathification law, a constitutional review, provincial elections. The surge was to open up space for political progress. And of course, they never got the slightest hint of any of that political progress year after year after year, before, during, and after the surge. And so you had this pretense that, well, the purpose of the surge was actually to reduce violence. And so as it happened, the surge coincided with a much longer-term downward trend in violence. It was largely the result of destruction and devastation and eviction and segregation of a population. I mean, you had ghost towns. You didn't have people, you know, singing in harmony with their neighbors. You had death and devastation, and you had this surge of 30,000 troops, which was absolutely minimal compared to what was there. At the same time, you had 10,000, you know, allied troops leaving, so it was a surge of 20,000, and you immediately had more violence where those troops went. And you had less violence where troops pulled out. When the British left Basra and the violence went away, the British were dumbfounded, and all the peace activists said, see, you know. And you had these claims about, well, in Anbar province, the surge reduced the violence. And it didn't. That is not what caused the reduction in violence. You had reduced violence because you had reduced actions. You had U.S. troops staying on their bases, not raiding people's houses. You had money being spent to buy off troops to not fight, and you had agreements to leave people's towns alone if they would stop the car bombers. You had Iran, to everyone's benefit, pushing Sadr to call a unilateral ceasefire, as he did. And critically, you had a public commitment to get out someday. That was part of the so-called surge. We're not staying forever. And when, in late 2008, you finally had that commitment to get out, that's when violence really went down. And as the troops pulled out, as the troops came out in 08, 09, you know, then you really saw reductions of violence where those troops left. I mean, there's nothing that de-escalates a war like de-escalating a war. And so this pretense that you fix a war by escalating it, you know, is absolute nonsense, but it's deadly nonsense, and it needs to be dealt with.
You know, I mean, thinking about it, the possible war with Iran over their developing nuclear weapons, it just seems to me, you know, it sounds so familiar, right? If they hadn't rehabilitated the Iraq war with this narrative, because very few of us have been to Iraq, very few of us have any independent knowledge of whether the surge was a success or not. But the fact that our corporate media has fed us that story every day now for 3 or 4 years makes the Iran war possible. If the Iraq war was left with the narrative that it deserved, I don't think there would be any talk of an Iran war because the American people wouldn't have it.
I totally agree. I mean, the American people, to their credit, maybe still won't have it. And they're in polls, they have been refusing to have it for years. And I think that was critical in 07 to the resistance to having it then. But I think that the movement is in that direction of accepting another war, despite the incredible similarities. I couldn't agree more.
Well, I said at the beginning of the show, this is my last thing for you, it's a real easy one. I said at the beginning of the show that as a young filmmaker, when we invaded Iraq, I was right at the beginning of my career in Los Angeles, and my first film had just come out, and I just was so ignorant of American history and about the relationship of the American people to their government and to declarations of war. I told Michael at the beginning, if someone had quizzed me about the Gulf of Tonkin, I might have mixed it up with the Bay of Pigs. That's how little I knew. And what concerns me is that whether it's Iran or some other war, when we start to talk about this again, that there'll be people who are 30 years old in the United States who are a little bit too young to remember 2002 or 2003, and they're not going to be able, if you quiz them, they're not going to be able to talk about the Downing Street memo or aluminum tubes or yellow cake or a Colin Powell. They probably won't even be able to know who he is other than he's the nice black guy who is Republican but defends Barack Obama. That's my concern. So I want you to do two things in your closing statement. For those people who listen to this show and still don't know what Gulf of Tonkin is, they didn't go look it up, explain what that was, and then connect it to the lesson you think that we need to be learning from the Vietnam War and also the Iraq War.
Well, the Gulf of Tonkin obviously is a location in Vietnam, and when President Lyndon Johnson wanted to escalate the war in Vietnam and he needed some sort of authorization from Congress along the lines of the 2001 and 2002 authorizations, there came this communication from a U.S. ship there that they had been fired upon by the Vietnamese, which would have been sensible given that U.S. ships had been firing on Vietnam. And in fact there came the immediate communication that no, looks like that was nothing. We aren't sure actually if there was anything there. Could have been whales or the wind, you know, and this was the understanding in the Pentagon, but the Pentagon went and the White House went to Congress and said the Vietnamese are attacking U.S. ships in the Gulf of Tonkin and we need an authorization to fight back. It's always defensive. It's always noble, defensive against savage behavior by the people who regretfully live in the territory where our ships are harmlessly patrolling and bombing the shores. And so this was an authorization that, like the 2001 and 2002 authorizations, was then stretched to allow a complete, unlimitless escalation into a year after year massive assault on the people of Vietnam that was about twice as deadly to Vietnam as the Iraq War that I started talking about was to Iraq. And so this is the reason why what you just described as your fear is exactly my fear, and it's why I wrote a book called War is a Lie, which I intended as a manual, as a guide, as a preemptive strike, that is, preempt the war lies, be prepared for the next war lies by understanding past war lies. That's why I wrote that book, in order to have people ready to grasp what they're being sold the next time they're sold this bill of goods. And I hate to close by promoting a book. If anybody can't afford a book, I'll get them a free one. But I also want to promote somebody else's book that I just read today that came out of Teaching for Change, Howard Zinn's project that is called How to Teach About War, where, in fact, you read essays by teachers in high schools and colleges describing how they've tried to teach the Gulf of Tonkin and how they've tried to teach the war on terror and so forth, and what they find students not knowing and needing to know, and how they can best expose them to thinking about it. And I can't recommend that book too highly.
Well, David Swanson, author of War is a Lie and other great books, inspired by, I think, the same thing that inspired many of Americans to become more active citizens, the invasion of Iraq. It was shocking, as you say. We're still not awed. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you. Keep up.
Yeah, I'd like to add my thanks to that as well, David. And by the way, I'm gonna end the show by plugging a book of yours, which is the one that caught my attention. You referred to earlier in the show, but very politely did not name it. It's called When the World Outlawed War. I've just actually picked up a copy of that, and I will read it on a plane this weekend.
Wonderful.
So I would recommend to everybody to go look, and I put the link to your author page on Amazon if anybody wants to take a look at some of the books that you've written. But thank you very much for being on. Very interesting, I'm sure controversial ideas for many people. But I hope, and again, apologies to the audience. I'm sure many of you would have liked to have asked David some questions, but perhaps we'll be able to lure him back onto the show in the future. It's been a joy and a quick almost 90 minutes. I very much appreciate your time.
Sounds great. Thanks. Talk to you later.
Thank you, David.
Thank you very much. And Eric, I think with all the technical glitches, we still had kind of an interesting show. next week, I'd like to mention a couple of things just before we sign off. Next week, I will be taking a leave for the week. I'm going to be out of town and unavailable for the show, so Eric will be flying solo. Actually, I think many of you will probably find that a more enlightening show because it won't be filled up with much of my extemporaneous drivel. So please tune in next week to listen to Eric on the Middle Ground. In the meantime, of course, on Thursday we have Lunch with Loudon, which is at noon Pacific. On Saturday, we have Egberto Willi's Politics Done Right, which I believe is at 1 Eastern, if I recall correctly. Mm-hmm. And Monday night, of course, Dan Aronson with Press One for Democracy, which is at 10 Eastern, 7 Pacific. Just as a last note, for those of you who haven't seen or noticed, our Coffee Party and Scoop It pages are littered with information about what we're referring to as the 535 campaign, which is the beginnings of our plan at the Coffee Party to get every one of our elected representatives on record with their plans or lack thereof relative to getting money out of politics and in specifically their plans to overturn Citizens United in some way. So please take a look on, again, any of our Scoop It pages on the Coffee Party main webpage, and you will find several citations to it on our Facebook pages. Check that out. Very important activity plan for the Coffee Party this year is to get all 535 of our representatives on record relative to money in politics, and we're going to need lots of you to help us track those people down, and we will post all the information that we find from all the representatives and senators across the country. Thank you, everyone, again for joining us. Again, apologize for the inability for people to call in, but we hope you enjoyed the show. Until next week, thank you from Eric and Michael from the Middle Ground.
That's our time for tonight. Thanks for joining us, and please share your comments and suggestions with us at conservatives.coffeepartyusa.com, where you can follow the Middle Ground and participate in the 99% media. Our theme was written and performed by The Consultants and produced by Van Gabriel. Please join us again next week on the Middle Ground. Until then, be wise, be strong,